There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So what does that look like? How do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Well, folks, we have equipping resources for you posted on our website, reconnectwithcarmen.com. We also interact with our listeners on Facebook and Twitter. On Twitter, I'm at Carmen LaBurge. I'd love to hear from you there. All right, so yesterday we talked about the Washington State Supreme Court ruling against 72-year-old grandmother and florist Baronelle Stutzman. And I had an opportunity earlier today to have a conversation with one of the attorneys at ADF, which is the Alliance Defending Freedom, that's working on that case. Here's my conversation with one of their attorneys. Friends, we're joined now by Carrie Kupek. She is the Legal Communications Director with the Alliance Defending Freedom. Since joining ADF in 2014, she's been responsible for East Coast media operations and advocating for religious liberty, sanctity of life, marriage, and the family. She's appeared on Fox and Friends. She's been interviewed and quoted in lots of media outlets. We're privileged to have her here with us today to talk about, in particular, the Baronelle Stutzman ruling yesterday and the Religious Liberty Executive Order that we're all hoping the president will sign. You can follow Carrie on Twitter at Carrie_Kupek. Carrie, welcome to The Reconnect.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so let's talk about the decision against Baronelle Stutzman yesterday in Washington State. If you'll just summarize the ruling for us and what it means.
Sure. So Baronelle Stutzman is the grandmother florist out of Washington State who has served customers in her shop, Arlene Flowers, for many decades. And she had a particular longtime customer and friend named Bob Ingersoll, who she served for close to a decade. And they had a great relationship. They enjoyed working together. Same-sex marriage became legal in Washington State. Rob came into Arlene Flowers, asked Baronelle to create custom flower arrangements to celebrate his same-sex wedding. Baronelle ultimately declined to do so. It was obviously a hard decision since they had a long-time relationship, but she declined to do so on the basis of her faith as a Christian, which teaches that marriage is a man-woman union. Next thing you know, Baronelle was being sued by Rob and his partner, as well as the Washington State Attorney General, in an unprecedented way. She was sued both professionally and personally, which means they were not just coming after her business, but her home, her retirement, her life savings, basically everything that she was worth. And unfortunately, the Washington State Supreme Court issued a unanimous ruling against Baronelle yesterday, saying that, yes, indeed, she had, quote, discriminated against Rob for declining to create this custom work for this one event, and that she should be punished accordingly.
All right, so I'll just admit to you that I will articulate the confusion that most Americans are feeling today, certainly most Christians. If she served him for close to a decade and she made arrangements for other events, for birthday parties, for celebrations, for holidays, whatever, and then how could she be accused of discrimination because of his sexual preference?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that was what bothered me the most about the decision that the Washington State Supreme Court issued yesterday. And that's they refused to make the distinction between the, quote, class of persons and an event. There's no Baronelle, obviously, like you said, she respectfully, she lovingly, she served this man for close to a decade. She was just drawing the line at a particular event. And this is a very narrow, narrow situation. This is a religious ceremony that directly violates her religious beliefs. And so we like to talk about the implications because they are seemingly endless. You would not want to force an Orthodox Jewish, say, painter to paint a mural that contradicted the teachings of the Torah under threat of severe government punishment. There's a lot of religious examples we could give. And what's interesting is that in the state of Washington, in Seattle specifically, political viewpoint is a protected class. So what does this mean? That means that in theory, someone, say, who was not a supporter of President Trump could be forced by his, you know, by the Republican Party to be his speechwriter. And this is not the kind of freedom that we know and cherish in America. This completely undermines the bedrock principle that all Americans should be free to peacefully live and operate consistent with their convictions and beliefs without threat of government punishment. And yesterday's decision seriously called that principle into question.
All right. So the ADF intends to appeal Ms. Stutzman, on Ms. Stutzman's behalf to the U.S. Supreme Court. Most Americans, you know, we know what the U.S. Supreme Court is. We know that it's, you know, short of justice right now. We're looking forward to those confirmation hearings for Neil Gorsuch. But explain to us what the process is. It's not like this case is going to be in front of the U.S. Supreme Court next week. So kind of walk us through what that process looks like and give us a maybe a sense of a timeline.
Well, we will be filing a petition for review at the Supreme Court very soon. And then the Supreme Court decides whether or not they will take the case. The Supreme Court has full discretion as to whether they will review this case. So it could take months for them to decide whether they're going to look at it. And ultimately, we obviously very much hope that the Supreme Court will review this case. There's no guarantee at all. But obviously, this is a brewing issue in this country, the likes of which we haven't seen before, because it really calls into question the ability and freedom of artists and creative professionals to be able to continue creating freely.
And to choose in which environments they do and do not share those particular talents. If people are interested in helping Baronel, what's one way they could do that?
They can go to letfreedombloom.com, and that will take them to a page that will help us continue to fight for Baronel. It'll also give your listeners all of the information they need on her case, her story. They can take a look at all the legal documents, and that page will be updated regularly with updates as far as where we're at with the cert petition for review, what happens at the Supreme Court if they decide to take it, and so forth.
Okay, great. So that's letfreedombloom.com, which is, by the way, a really, really cute URL. All right, Carrie, let's change gears here a little bit. I want to get to a conversation about the executive order on religious liberty that is in front of President Trump. But let's start with something that I hear ADF talk about a lot, and that is this concept that civil liberties travel together.
You know, studies have shown again and again that in countries where religious freedom is protected, freedom at all levels thrives. I think Americans sometimes have this odd concept of what it means to protect religious freedom, and they kind of put it in a box. But civil liberties do travel together, and there's a reason that freedom of religion is our first freedom. And so we see in countries where religious freedom is cherished and valued, we see this thriving of freedom, and we see economies thriving and communities thriving as a result. And speaking of economies thriving, there was a great study put out by some Georgetown professors a few months ago. They did a study where they took into account all the goods and services provided by faith-based organizations from across the country. And it turns out the value of those goods and services provided by faith-based organizations total up to something over $1 trillion annually. These are these great social welfare services that are keeping at-risk youth in great programs. These are the homeless shelters, the battered women's shelters, and the list just goes on and on. But over $1 trillion annually is their value.
All right. And so let's connect that to this conversation about this religious liberty executive order that we're all hoping President Trump will sign. It protects all kinds of religious freedoms. But your interest is in this connection that it has sort of the wider conversation about the impact. So can you share that with us?
Yes. So this executive order lines up squarely with President Trump's campaign promise to make religious freedom, protecting religious freedom, his, quote, first priority. And President Trump campaigned actively on that principle because he saw, and people were complaining to him a lot about the fact that under the Obama administration, religious liberty came under attack in a new way. And so here are some of the things that the Religious Freedom Executive Order would do. It tells the entire federal government to respect federal statutes and Supreme Court decisions that make clear the free exercise of religion applies to all people of all faiths. It's not just a freedom to worship. It's a freedom to actually exercise one's religion. It instructs HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, to finally grant relief to the Little Sisters of the Poor and others like the Evangelical Christian Colleges that Alliance Defending Freedom represents, who weren't exempted from the Obamacare abortifacient and contraception mandate. And these are the organizations that have a moral objection to providing life-ending drugs and devices and, in some cases, birth control within their health insurance plans for their employees. And it prevents the government from discriminating against people of faith for their beliefs on marriage. And these are federal employees, contractors, and those who would receive federal money. And so when we saw this religious liberty executive order leak a few weeks ago, I don't think anyone was really surprised, and we were happy because all it does is respect people's faith. And so this religious liberty order just restores some balance of back into the freedom discussion and ensures that people of faith will not be discriminated against by the government.
All right. That's Carrie Kupek from the Alliance Defending Freedom. Carrie, thank you for being with us today on The Reconnect. You guys can follow her at Carrie_Kupek. Okay, friends. So there's other religious liberty news today out of a court, the Federal Appeals Court, in a 2-1 decision. This is the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. So this is like Michigan and Ohio, that kind of region of the country. And this is in relationship to the Jackson County Board of Commissioners, who the Jackson County Board of Commissioners is a county in Michigan. Everybody that is on the county commission happen to be Christians. They happen to begin their meetings, which is absolutely recognized as protected under the First Amendment, as under free exercise, as well as under freedom of speech, for them to open their meetings with a prayer. And so they do that. Now, because they're all Christians and because they're the ones offering the prayers are all, you guessed it, Christian. Well, that was apparently offensive to one resident of Jackson County, and he brought this charge against the county commission, and his concern has now been upheld by this circuit court of appeals, the Sixth Circuit. Okay, so here's basically what's happened. 2 out of 3 judges on this appeals court panel have judged that for these elected government commissioners to be offering these prayers, because they all happen to be Christians, they're not offering prayers from a variety of religions, and therefore it is as if there's no distinction, this is what they say, between the government and the prayer giver, as if they are one and the same, as literally as if it is government speech. That is what these 2 judges of this 3-judge panel have said. Now, I will say that the dissent, which is by Judge Richard Griffin and is worth reading, he dissented to the court's majority opinion by his 2 female counterparts who are on the panel with him. And he appealed to U.S. Supreme Court decisions related to public prayers in his dissent. However, the ruling of this 2-judge panel is going to stand unless it is overturned by a higher court. So here's the challenge that we're faced with. If it's okay to pray in public meetings, but it's not okay for public officials to pray in public meetings if all of those public officials all happen to be people of the same faith and therefore happen to all pray in the same faith. And so this is certainly a religious liberty conversation that I believe is going to be ongoing. I think this is a story that we're going to want to watch. So you're going to want to put a little pin in your mental calendar and say, hey, I need to keep track of that Jackson County Commission decision related to prayer at county commission meetings, because I think ultimately this affects every single one of us across the country. And this is what we have to keep in mind. It doesn't matter if we're talking about, a florist who lives in a small town and has a really small business in Richland, Washington, or if we're talking about county commissioners in the county of Jackson, Michigan. We're talking about all of us, and we're talking about each of us, and we're talking about the religious liberty and the religious freedom that we enjoy in this country, and the coercion we are now experiencing by our own government through the action of our courts. And so this is definitely something to watch. I'll move from the religious liberty front to the life front.
The U.S. House of Representatives voted yesterday to overturn a rule put in place very late in the Obama administration. In fact, it just went into effect in December that prevented states from being able to use the funds that they receive through something called Title 10 in the way that they see fit. So here's basically what's going on. The Obama administration wanted to block states like Tennessee in particular from taking their Title 10 funds and giving them to subrecipients of those funds to be able to do that in such a way that they did not fund any Planned Parenthood clinics or services related to abortion across the state of Tennessee. So essentially, that's what's going on here. So it might not surprise you that one of the people who put forward this particular piece of legislation is Diane Black, Republican from Tennessee. But she put this legislation forward with Senator Joni Ernst from Iowa. And these two bills were filed both in the House and in the Senate. And if passed now, what's House Resolution 43, if it's subsequently passed by the Senate and signed by the president, it would mean that states, if they so choose, could continue to redirect their Title 10 funds away from what they might consider objectionable organizations, such as Planned Parenthood. So that happened yesterday in the House. If you are supportive of that action, then I'd encourage you to let your senators know that you are supportive of defunding Planned Parenthood. This is one way that we go about doing that. And you say to yourself, I didn't really know that my taxpayer dollars were going to fund Planned Parenthood. Well, then you're not paying attention. Because that's exactly what's happening. The Obama administration made sure that Title 10 funding was actually then tied to funding Planned Parenthood. And so this is a way of decoupling those realities. So here's essentially how the state of Tennessee, I'm going to use it as my illustrative example here. This is the way the state of Tennessee does it. So currently, state law in the state of Tennessee doles out Title 10 funding which is provided by HHS. Now, keep in mind, this is about federal taxes that are collected across the United States of America. We send our tax money to the federal government, and they then send it back to the states through their various entities and agencies and departments for various and specific things. So this is our money to start with. Let's be clear about that. Okay, so people from the state of Tennessee send their federal tax dollars to the U.S. government through the IRS, and the IRS, you know, it doles it back out in some. It's one way of thinking about it. And so HHS gets some of that money, and some of that money that HHS gets from federal taxes, they dole out through what are called Title 10 funding. So the state of Tennessee has a state law that says how that Title 10 funding is then distributed through county health departments. And those county health departments then in turn determine who their sub grantees are going to be. Well, all of the 95 counties in the state of Tennessee have identified community health centers and other health providers that do not include Planned Parenthood, who meet all the Title 10 eligibility criteria to receive the funding, and therefore they effectively cut off Planned Parenthood in terms of access to federal Title 10 funding in the state of Tennessee. As other states looked at what Tennessee was doing and say, that's a pretty good idea. Let's follow that model. The Obama administration says, let's shut that down. Let's shut that down now. And that is what the House of Representatives has now undone, was the Obama administration's late in the game effort to control the way states disperse their Title 10 funding that is received through federal tax distribution. Okay, so that's a good news story, and we want to lift up good news stories as we find them and as they exist. Okay, moving from that to anytime the woolly mammoth appears in a headline, I'm probably going to bring it to you on the Reconnect simply because that seems to be like it's worth talking about. So this caught my eye. Scientists say they will bring back the woolly mammoth from extinction, and they're going to do it in 2 years. So now I got to tell you, if you're going to bring something back from extinction, it sort of makes me wonder what the word extinct or the word extinction means at all. Like, I think that if you get to the place where science can start bringing back animals that are extinct, then those who are like sort of working to prevent the extinction of animals, those who want there to be all of this public funding to protect endangered species, I think they're going to find themselves in a little bit of a challenge, because scientists are just going to be able to say, hey, you know what, when it's time and when we're ready and when we got space for that and like a good food source, we'll just bring it back. extinction's not really extinction, not anymore, because, hey, we know how to manipulate those genes now. We know how to make things live again. So I could go all kinds of directions with this conversation. Here's basically the story. Harvard, no surprise, smarty pants people at Harvard. According to Harvard University geneticist Professor George Church and his team, the extinct Ice Age creature known as the woolly mammoth may not be extinct for too much longer. In fact, they think they can bring it back within 2 years as a mammoth-elephant hybrid. All right, they're going to reconstruct the DNA blueprint for the mammoth using the DNA found in the preserved remains of frozen mammoths found in the Arctic. They're going to splice those genes into elephant embryos, and voila! We will have some kind of elephant-mammoth hybrid wandering around in the world. Now, here is what is so curious to me. This sort of gets into the conversation of just because you can do it doesn't mean you should. Have you considered the size and scope of a woolly mammoth? Have you considered where on earth they're going to live and what they're going to eat and what else they may displace? I realize that this is a curiosity for scientists and sounds like a really, you know, interesting, fun experiment to do. But for them to say, this is so funny, they say, hey, we actually think that the woolly mammoth or the elephant mammoth hybrid could have a positive effect on the environment because it would allow the endangered Asian elephant from going extinct, putting them in much colder climates, and they can combat global warming. You say to yourself, well, how? Well, apparently they stomp around on the tundra and they punch through the snow and allow the cold air to come in, and that will help the tundra no longer thaw, which keeps things frozen. All right, anyway. And then they say in the summer they knock down trees and they help grass grow. And I'm thinking, where in the world is that a problem? Okay, you can see that where I'm probably going with this, and this is a conversation of just because we can doesn't mean we should. We have had this conversation before on occasion where technology is definitely getting ahead of ethics, certainly getting ahead of Christian ethics. So that reminded me of this story from a couple of days ago that I have had lying here and I want to lift up to you. It was in the New York Times. It was also covered in the Wall Street Journal and others. Let me just read the headline. Human Gene Editing Receives Science Panel's Support. So Amy Harmon is the author of this. It's in the February 14 edition of the New York Times. Here is the opening paragraph. An influential science advisory group formed by the National Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Medicine on Tuesday lent its support to, get this, New York Times writer writing this, a once unthinkable proposition, the modification of human embryos to create genetic traits that can be passed down to future generations. This type of human gene editing has long been seen as an ethical minefield. And you say to yourself, well, what kind of ethical minefield? What kind of ethics are we basing our conversations on these days? When the issue is not, no one is raising any concern anymore, by the way, that they are doing these experiments on human embryos. No one is concerned about that. That is apparently an ethical hurdle we have completely overcome as a society. No, the concern is what they're editing those human embryos to be or to do. And so ultimately the question is going to come down to, if you scroll far enough down in the article, there's this question. We can now see a path whereby we might be able to do it. And so now we have to think about how to make sure it's used only for the right things and not for the wrong things. What they're saying is the technology has gotten way ahead of the ethics. We can now edit human embryos to edit out disease strains that are inheritable traits. That also means we could edit in inheritable traits that we prefer, like strength or intelligence or beauty. It raises all kinds of ethical concerns. Unfortunately, one of the ethical concerns not raised is the issue of manipulating what God hath made. Nobody seems concerned. What we're manipulating here is our human embryos. Now, the author does get to that point when she makes this statement. After decades of science fiction movies, cocktail party chatter, and college seminars in which people have idly debated the ethics of humanity intervening in its own evolution, advancing technology now means we have to talk about it. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. We'll be right back and we'll keep talking about it. Stay with me through the break.
Welcome back to The Reconnect with your host, Carmen LaBurge. Now, back to Carmen.
Hello, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about what the headlines are. What the headlines include, we're talking about what people are talking about. We're seeking to equip you to be the ambassadors of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. We certainly invite you to connect with us online. Our website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. Let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends. So it was just yesterday that in South Carolina, we were reminded again of the name of Dylann Roof. And so I'm going to have a conversation here with Jennifer Barry Hawes. And Jennifer is a journalist at the Post and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina. If you have been reading coverage of Dylann Roof, you have been reading Jennifer Barry Hawes. She worked on the Pulitzer Prize-winning team that produced Till Death Do Us Part about South Carolina's domestic violence epidemic. She's a former National Religion Writer of the Year and the current South Carolina Journalist of the Year. She's writing Amazing Grace, a book about the Emmanuel AME Church massacre, which all of us remember from June of 2015. Her book will be published by St. Martin's Press later this year in 2017. You can follow her on Twitter at Jen Barry Hawes. Jen, welcome to The Reconnect.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for what you do. It was just yesterday that we read coverage by your colleague Glenn Smith that the FBI has arrested a Conway, South Carolina man who has a criminal record and acknowledges that he's a white supremacist, and then he was planning to launch an attack in the spirit of Dylann Roof. And I want to ask you about that phrase from your experiences, which cover the full breadth of what happened at the Emmanuel AME Church in June of 2015 and every event subsequent to that related to Dylann Roof. When you hear someone say they want to do something in the spirit of Dylann Roof, what does that mean to you?
Well, to me, it has clear ties to white supremacy and the message that Dylann Roof was trying to send. He wrote at length before the shooting and then again while he was in jail about his views of white people as the superior race and the wrongs that he perceived non-white people as having perpetrated on whites. And when I hear that phrase, that's the first thing that I think of. But then, of course, you can't get beyond the fact that he committed this crime in a church against African Americans. And when I hear that phrase, I begin to wonder if this man was contemplating some sort of similar act in a house of worship. And in fact, he had included a link to a synagogue. There doesn't appear to be an indication that he had a target at this point. But nonetheless, when you hear that phrase, in my mind anyway, I think of a house of worship.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have read your coverage, or I have read your coverage, maybe not all of our listeners have, but you you processed your way through the stories of the survivors, you heard the testimony of the family members of the victims. I'm wondering if there's a story that stands out to you, the story of one of those individuals that you would just like to share today.
I think all along the story of the survivors has been the one that's really drawn me to this and made me feel just as a human being the enormity of the tragedy. The three people who are in the room, there were 12 people gathered that night for the Bible study. Nine of them, of course, were killed, and three survived, two adults and a little girl who was 11 years old at the time, the granddaughter of one of the survivors. And the first time I really became engaged in the story after it was a breaking news story was when the two adult women spoke publicly for the first time. And I remember going to one of their homes, Felicia Sanders, and meeting with them and hearing for the first time the very detailed account of what had happened in there. And it's just unfathomable to imagine what it would be like to be studying the Bible with your close friends and people, in her case, she'd known her entire life, and to know they were being shot and killed all around you, and among them is your son. I have a son, and I've often tried to imagine what that would be like, and I cannot do it because it's so awful. And hearing Felicia's story, and Polly Shepherd was the other adult survivor in the room, Polly was under a table praying out loud during the shooting, when Dylan Roof approached her and asked if he had shot her. Polly said no, and he said, well, I'm going to leave you here to tell the story. And after that, Felicia Sanders' son confronted him. He'd already been shot, and he said, why are you doing this? We mean you no harm. And Dylan Roof shot him right then and there and said, y'all are raping our women and killing our people, and made it clear that his motive was race-related. You know, there's just nothing that can make me as a human being and a mother imagine what that must have been like for Felicia laying there playing dead with her granddaughter as her son said these words and then was killed. So I have to say, of all of the sadness and grief that I've heard, their stories have always just stuck out in my mind and made me think of just what would I have done in those moments, their strength and their faith, and the faith that continued to sustain them after that was just, for me, very humbling and has been very humbling throughout all of this coverage. They've just never wavered, and they've had many difficulties since then and have still just been so remarkable, so dedicated to their faith that I hate to sound corny, but it really is just inspiring. And their stories have stuck with me throughout for that reason. They're just so admirable.
So I'm wondering, with that faith component in mind, and in particular, the witness of the rest of the Emmanuel AME congregation in response to this, and the witness that that has been in the city of Charleston, can you kind of tell us what the posture of these families, these survivors, and the posture of the Emmanuel AME Church, how that played into the way the city of Charleston responded to this and to subsequent racial challenges?
Well, remember that the Emmanuel shooting occurred just 2 months after the shooting death of Walter Scott in North Charleston, which is a different city, but nonetheless a neighboring city. So when the Emmanuel shooting occurred, the city was already somewhat on edge. That shooting had left a lot of people talking about some historic racial discord in the city. Obviously, Charleston has an enormous history when it comes to oppression, segregation, slavery. It was the number one slave port in the country. And so the community was already talking about some of these issues when Emmanuel occurred. And there was instant fear that the city would erupt into violence, as we had seen in places like Ferguson and Baltimore. But that did not happen, and much of the credit, I think, goes to the fact that at Dylan Roof's bond hearing, which was about 48 hours after the shooting, a number of the family members spoke. Felicia Sanders was among them. And they spoke about forgiveness. They said things like, I forgive you. They spoke about repentance. Anthony Thompson is a pastor in a different denomination whose wife was killed in the shooting, and he urged Dylan Roof to repent and to be saved and that his life could be better. And the words that they spoke, not ones of hate or revenge or even anger, were remarkable. And the city reacted to that. I think people were really able to unite behind the idea of this being a horrific crime committed by a racist, hateful person in a church. It really allowed people to come together and show that kind of unity. It was very inspiring. After that, you know, Charleston faced some real questions. People had to really decide what they were going to do with this energy. And certain things, I think, frustrated people in terms of not being able to pass, for instance, gun reforms. That was a big issue with a lot of the family members who wanted to see background checks boosted, because Dylan Roof was not supposed to be able to purchase a gun. He shouldn't have been able to pass a background check, but his background check was delayed due to a clerical error, and so the gun shop owners were legally able to sell it to him. His background check didn't come back in time. So there was a lot of discussion of gun reform and race relations, and one of the more positive things that came out of all of those discussions was that the Charleston Police Chief Greg Mullen launched an effort called the Illumination Project, and it did a couple things. One is it brought people from different denominations together for prayer services where they would meet people they might not otherwise get to know, black pastors and white pastors. Charleston, like much of the country, is still very segregated on Sunday morning, and it brought pastors from all different kinds of churches together to pray together and meet each other and fellowship. And the other thing the Illumination Project did was it brought people in the community together to talk about police and community relations and race relations and have some of the more difficult conversations. So you saw all of this stuff going on after the shooting. But when I go out and talk, I used to be the religion writer at our newspaper, and when I go out and talk to people in the community, I had coffee just today with an AME minister, and there's frustration that more hasn't been done as far as remnants of segregation, economic disparities, school disparities, and those sorts of things. But what has come of it is a greater degree of conversation about race and more ecumenical involvement among pastors in the city. So, you know, it's not all kumbaya, but there is room for hope, I think, that those conversations and friendships that were born out of the church shooting will continue, and so we'll see. But I think in the church community, that's been a very encouraging step.
Well, Jen, we appreciate in particular how you, as a journalist, do such a fine job of showing and not telling, because I think that today so much of journalism migrates over into telling us what to think, telling us what to see, telling us how to feel about something. And you did a masterful job, and I'm really looking forward to reading your book that covers this same subject, but you've done such a masterful job letting the people who have experienced this speak for themselves, and you have helped the rest of us empathize. So one of the things that I'll share with you that leapt out at me of when you talk about Polly Shepherd and you talk about, you know, what Dylann Roof said to her, and I'm, as a person of faith, I am acknowledging that this is quite similar to, you know, what Jesus tells his disciples, like, I'm leaving you as my witnesses. And she has been such a profound witness to Christ and steadfast throughout this. And so thank you for being the person who has helped the rest of us hear these stories, see these people, and you've done it in such a way where you have really honored your profession as well. So folks, I'm talking with Jennifer Barry Hawes. You can follow her on Twitter at Jen Barry Hawes, and you can read what she is writing at Charleston's Post and Courier. We look forward to your forthcoming book, Amazing Grace, later this year, and it's going to be published by St. Martin's Press. I hope you will come back and talk with us about that when it's out.
Well, I'd love to, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Jen. All right, folks, this continues to be a story that has changed who we are as a people. It has changed the way that many people in the South have even thought about entering into conversations that are difficult to have but are so totally necessary. And so if this is not a story that you followed all along, I would just encourage you, you could just Google Jen's name, and a series of articles related to this is gonna pop up, and you could just read through them, according to their date, and you can actually just read a chronicle of the events in Charleston, South Carolina. So I encourage you to do that. All right, it is that time in the show where we like to go below the fold and lift up stories and make connections that are designed to help you start and engage with your neighbors in conversations that, well, they might not initially appear to be about God. In fact, today's might look like they mock God. But it's your opportunity to introduce the eternal principles that can change not only that conversation, but maybe the course of another person's thinking. And you and I both know the power of a changed thought.
My first one that I have for you, I mean, hold on to your hats and your handrails. It's called "This Church in Vermont Was Built for Dogs. Fido's Owners Are Welcome Too." So this is a Megan Barber reporting, and she tells us that in northern Vermont, about 2 hours east of Burlington, there's a white chapel. It at first looks like a traditional New England church until, of course, you read the sign, which says, "Welcome all creeds, all breeds, no dogmas allowed." It's a 150-acre mountaintop farm called Dog Mountain, and it's been welcoming dog lovers since it opened in the year 2000. And it's really a church that, well, it's gone to the dogs. There's no two ways about it. Inside, if you go inside, there are lovely hand-carved items and beautiful stained glass windows. But I think that the feature that they seek to lift up is that people put up pictures of their departed pets, their departed dogs in particular. And it raises the conversation about whether or not animals are soulish, whether or not dogs go to heaven. And, excuse me, this is a conversation that is had at sort of all levels of society and in all age groups and in a time when more Americans have dogs probably than have kids. Not totally sure on that. That might be a made-up statistic here on the spot. But a lot of people have dogs, and a lot of people spend a lot of money on their dogs. A lot of people refer to their dogs as babies. And when their baby gets sick, I mean, they need a sick day from work. And they spend a lot of money on the cancer treatments for their pet. And I'm not exaggerating here. I know people like this. And so I have dogs. We have dogs. Our dogs are working dogs. They live out in an orchard where their job is to keep other pests away. They do a fine job of that. We have a working relationship with them. And yes, over time, I will admit to you that I have had Luddy and Stuart and Daisy. Oh, Daisy was our cat. But you get the point. I don't know over the course of my life maybe how many dogs there have been. There have been a lot of dogs. Here's the question that people ask. You know, the Bible speaks to all creatures, great and small, speaks to God as the creator of all things. And we get to the place where we ask the question, well, what happens to our pets when they die? Now, regardless of your wishful thinking, regardless of our evolutionary confusion, animals are not human, and humans are not animals. God made and declares them all good, but we're not all the same. There's a reason that the Apostle Paul says all creation groans with eager longing for man's redemption. Because, you see, in the fall of humanity, all creation suffers the consequences. Everything dies. And ultimately, everything is going to be redeemed. There will, one day, Scripture promises us, be a new heaven on the new earth. And yes, in that new heaven on the new earth, Scripture attests to the fact there will be animals. The question is whether or not there will be the animal in some redeemed form, who you have loved and now lost. There is biblical evidence for the presence of animals in the new kingdom on the new earth. But there's no biblical evidence that particular, individual animals go to heaven. If you're looking for a good resource on this, there's one posted at Christianity.com. It was posted back in April of 2012. And it's entitled, "Do Pets Go to Heaven?" I would encourage you to read it. All right, now I have a little public service announcement to liberal protesters. I know I may not have a lot of liberal protesters listening right now, so this might be a podcast that you want to go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and you want to get, and you want to send it to liberal protesters. Because I have a public service announcement today for liberal protesters. Pick up after yourselves. Seriously. Pick up after yourselves. Your mom may still pick up after you at home, but that is not the way it works out here in the real world. If you make a mess, you clean it up. It's called litter. You are in violation of more than one ordinance, not to mention making a mockery of your own movement. Liberal protesters, if you make a mess, Clean it up. Pick up your own trash. Clean up after yourselves. You say to yourself, why is Carmen harping on this? Well, because in North Dakota, you and I, as federal taxpayers, are now pumping out millions of dollars to clean up the garbage that was left by all the pipeline protesters. All those people who were protesting that the Dakota Access Pipeline was going to possibly, in their minds, pollute the Missouri River. Well, guess what? They have left so much garbage and human waste and building materials scattered across this camp near Cannonball River that there's now concern that once the weather warms up and the snow melt happens, this area will flood and all of this trash and debris and human waste that people left behind is going to end up where? In the Missouri River, polluting the waterways. You liberal protesters, clean up after yourselves. This is such evidence of self-interest and the way people do not pay attention to the consequences of their own behavior. Okay. Here's what the Corps of Engineers is saying. With the amount of people that have been out there, the amount of estimated waste and trash they left behind, there's a good chance it's going to end up in the river if it's not cleaned up. Officials estimate there's enough trash and debris in the camp to fill about 2,500 pickup trucks. Garbage ranges from trash to building debris to human waste. Now, why is it there? Well, you might remember that this camp is on federal land near the pipeline route. Now, there's only a few hundred people there now. They're protesting a $3.8 billion project to move North Dakota oil to Illinois. And the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and others believed that the pipeline could leak. And it would leak under the Missouri River and it would contaminate the water. Well, guess what? The wingnuts who went to protest it have now left behind so much human waste and garbage and building materials in their makeshift camp that they set up on federal land that the Missouri River is almost now assuredly going to be contaminated. Now, to their credit, the Sioux Tribe has asked protesters to leave the area, and they have actually been coordinating the cleanup at the camp since late last month. At this point in time, $6 million that people around the world contributed to the tribe in the pipeline fight is now being used as a part of the cleanup effort. We're really fighting the clock. We're working around the clock, they're saying, but there's more garbage down there than anybody anticipated. There's more garbage down there than anybody anticipated. That is, my friends, the nature of sin. There's more garbage down there than you could ever anticipate. There's certainly more garbage down there than our first parents anticipated. We call it total depravity. The depth of our sin runs deep, and it spreads wide, and it contaminates our lives. That's not really what we started out going after. We were protesting the authority of God over our lives, but what we ended up with was a life that's a mess, and we've made a mess of creation along the way. So, liberal or conservative today, if you make a mess, clean it up. Now, the good news is the Father has sent the Son to clean up what we never could. And that would be my shout out to Jesus today, for making us white as the driven snow, even though our sin runs so deep. All right, friends, that's all we got time for today. This is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We got lots of resources for you today at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Have a great weekend, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.